collaboration with AMI. And certainly I want to encourage those of you here today who desire to attend our convention, conference rather, in Chicago. What are the dates? September 14th and 15th. 14th through the 17th. Please come to share with us. I am going to share a few words on today's topic, and then I'm going to yield to Jamie Walton and Joe Bongiovanni for some remarks, and then we can sort of open up the floor for dialogue and conversation. I am calling my talk The New Abolitionism. It is a term that I have attempted to train and coin to refer to our need to free and to liberate the public from debt or interest slavery. I'm calling this The New Abolitionism, Monetary Reform, and the Future of Human Rights. Now, I use this title. Many of you may wonder why I'm using this title. And many of you know that the struggle for the private issuance of money and the bondage it imposes on the public, it's not a new idea. It's not a new struggle. This is not a new issue. But I use it marking for branding purposes in my yet-to-be-realized attempt to popularize the issue of monetary reform among civil rights leaders and faith leaders, primarily in the African-American context and community out of which I come. And so the key strategy for opposing money reform, I think the key strategy for opposing money reform by the financial elite is to change the subject. Many of you recall that after the global financial crisis and the Occupy movement had gripped the nation and even the world, I believe in large part the eyes of the public were focused in the right direction. Now we have begun to focus as a nation on race relations and police shootings. These are legitimate issues. I do not want to minimize, disregard them at all. But it is interesting to me that our focus nationally has gotten away from and off of Wall Street and the banks in the way we were 2008, 2009, 2010. We're seeing repeals of Dodd-Frank, and certainly those are not sufficient solutions in and of themselves. But we've gotten our eyes off the ball. I grew up playing baseball, and I would like to think I was a good hitter. But whenever I was in a hitting slump, my father would also say, Delman, you got to keep your eye on the ball. And I think that if we're going to see the kind of progress we need to see today, we need to invite the public to keep our eyes on the ball. And I use the new abolitionism as a trope, troping off of Michelle Alexander's very powerful usage of the term the new Jim Crow to talk about mass incarceration as a continuation of a prior legacy of systemic oppression in this country. And so since abolition of chattel slavery in the United States has a long-established legacy in this country, one that served as a unifying meta-narrative, and I want to talk about this a bit later, the way in which abolitionism served and provided a unifying meta-narrative to bring together people across various racial, religious, and class backgrounds and contexts. In the same way abolitionism provided that kind of unifying meta-narrative for those concerned about justice, fairness, and morality and our democracy, I've been thinking about the new abolitionism for conceptual currency to connect those in the communities that I serve with allies across various racial, religious, and political boundaries to focus on this issue, money reform, as a unifying narrative to link the fragmented fellowships on the left and really the fragmented 99.9% in America. Because really, regardless of your political label, we are all victims of this money system. Mm-hmm. It is the one thing, regardless of your race, religion, class, gender, sexual orientation, that links all of us. And that's money. And so it seems to me that we need to think about an issue that links us rather than frames that may distinguish us. If we seek to develop a movement that brings folks in Appalachia with those on the south side of Chicago, we're gonna have to think about a narrative in my mind that invites us to a similar conversation. Tolstoy said that money is a new form of slavery and distinguishable from the old simply by the fact that it is impersonal, that there is no human relationship between master and slave, unquote. And I want to come back to that at the end of our talk today about, I want to talk about this need, as I just alluded to, a unifying meta-narrative as a means towards creating the kind of broader popular discourse that we so desperately need for those who identify as progressives and are concerned about the common good. And so I want to begin my talk by talking about my own journey to becoming a money reformer, because perhaps there are some connections with my own journey. I'm not an economist. I am not a historian. I am not a political scientist. I am a Black Baptist preacher. I serve a congregation of almost 10,000 African American members in Clinton, Maryland, just outside of the nation's capital. I am deeply steeped and rooted in the Black church's tradition of social justice. And my ideals, the ideals of the Black church are articulated in perhaps our most notable representative of the freedom fighting tradition of African American Christianity, and that's none other than the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. King has this quote, he says, "Any religion that professes to be concerned about the souls of men and women, but is not concerned about the slums that damn them, the economic conditions that strangle them, and the social conditions that cripple them, is a spiritually dead religion awaiting burial." And so the pursuit of the beloved community for all people through the promotion of equality, fairness, and the proportionate distribution of material resources by confronting unjust systems, governments, practices, and policies, and power relationships is at the heart of both our civic and ethical witness. And for those who identify as religious, our spiritual witness as well. And so I want to suggest that the success of America's pluralistic democracy can be significantly advanced through the reintegration of religious progressives in American public life. It has become too common to sort of dismiss people of faith from these kinds of conversations. And I get it, because those who identify as religious have advanced everything that's antithetical to what is consistent with our American civic values and our spiritual values as well. But I want to contend that as an African American clergy leader and churches across the country who represent the Black church tradition, that a historical and theoretical construct rooted in the legacy of social justice activism, Christian love, and equality have been and continue to be vital forces of civic engagement, inclusion, economic justice, and social transformation. I have seen it. 5 years ago is largely because of my own outspokenness for marriage equality in the state of Maryland, that we were successful in Maryland at defeating attempts to deny the LGBT community of equal rights under the law, which really is a statement to me of the power and the potential of people of faith in the progressive movement. I must note that, because I am coming out of this tradition where the prevailing notions of Black clergy, Black preaching, and Black churches tends to be decidedly conservative, decidedly regressive. And I want to, you know, really model something different for America and different for our society. And so this is decidedly and so this commitment to social transformation is connected with the historic faith traditions of Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and the other major faith traditions of our world that have had a historic critique and position against usury. Usury is not just excessive interest. If you have not read Stephen Zarlinga's The Lost Science of Money, I really encourage you to read this. The definition of usury as excessive interest was a strategy or a ploy used by those who sympathize with bankers to convince the church to give up its historic position on usury. That by defining usury as excessive interest, it provided the pathway for getting theologians and philosophers at the time to become open to some interest. And this began to open the door to the historic position of these major faith traditions of the world against usury. Usury, macro usury, is the immoral, unjust manipulation of money. It is the idea that money should not make money in and of itself. My commitment to monetary reform as a clergy leader is committed to social justice, and it is my view that monetary reform must become the number one human and civil rights issue of our day. That's my commitment. I hope to explain that. And so that became clear to me, I would say, around 2009. My work since 2009 to address the foreclosure crisis which devastated Prince George's County, Maryland, where I pastored. If you know anything about Prince George's County, Maryland, it is touted in some quarters as having the highest, the wealthiest population of African Americans in the country. So it goes back and forth between Prince George's County, Maryland, and Fulton County or DeKalb County in Atlanta. Well, our community was devastated by the global financial crisis, and it was over the context of helping people try to stay in their homes, remain in their homes, that I really discovered the complete immoral practice of mortgage and foreclosure fraud that was at the foundation of the global financial crisis. I believe I sort of became this de facto expert on securitizations, collateralized debt obligations, all this other kind of stuff, and trying to keep people in their homes. And I wanted to understand, why is it that the same criminals that got us in this mess became richer while the rest of the country became poorer? That their practices have resulted in the largest transfer of wealth in human history. I believe one speaker said it yesterday, but I want to accent it. When your home goes underwater, when your home is foreclosed on, that value is not lost. It is transferred. That wealth is not lost or transferred. And we saw the largest confiscation of black wealth in history. Not just black wealth, but wealth in general, but certainly in the community that I pastor, we've seen the largest confiscation of wealth in history. And think about the insanity of what was happening and continues to happen. Banks securitized notes, then they insured the notes, and then when the homeowners failed, defaulted, and the banks wanted them to default, they made the taxpayer bail them out. And so they privatized profits, and then they socialized the risk. And at that point, I thought that the solution to our economic justice problems, at that time, I thought were just about financial regulatory provisions that needed to be in place. That all we needed to do was to have an economically just and fair society was to rein in the banks. We hear this oftentimes. And while these reforms are necessary and are appealing, in and of themselves, financial regulations are not enough, because they are built on the premise that the global financial crisis happened because of an absence of cops on Wall Street. But what if the crisis happened not because of a lack of policing on the street, but because there was something wrong with the street itself? That there was something wrong with the foundation of the street itself, and not just that there were insufficient cops on Wall Street, came into view for me when I discovered that when homeowners are given mortgages, the bank never actually loaned them any money. Now, if you ask 10 people, when you get a mortgage, where did the bank get the money for that mortgage? 11 of them will say, From the vault, from deposits, that they aggregate savings and they loan me what was deposited. 12 out of 10 will say, that's where it comes from. And not only will the average citizen say this, but politicians will say the same. Many thought leaders will say the same. But when one realizes that people go into 30 years of debt or interest servitude to an institution and an industry that never loaned them any money. There was no consideration. And due to tricky accounting, what happens is that the bank was able to sell notes because the notes are assets and not liabilities. I don't want to get into this. I'm still trying to make my way to money reform. But that's when the light came on for me, because I was reminded of a quote from Dr. King, who was himself quoting Victor Hugo in the aftermath of riots in the 60s. Here's what King said. If a soul lives in darkness, sins will be committed. But the guilty one is not the one who commits the sins, but the one who causes the darkness. Unquote. What King is laying out for us is a paradigm on how we might fight injustice in the world today. And the only way to do that, he contends, is to understand the archaeology or the origins of injustice, or the root cause of the problem. King, if you read him, he talks a lot about derivative injustices, or second order injustices, or causative injustices. And as long as we are addressing the symptoms and leave the root cause in place, we are merely spinning our wheels and we're never addressing the problem. Can I give you a conceptual metaphor?
Yes.
I say, can I give you a conceptual metaphor?
Yes. Yes.
If this room were flooded with water, and I gave you, and the water is pouring onto the floor from the sink, and I gave you a mop and a bucket, and I said, clean up the water. If you took the mop and the bucket and just started mopping the floor, but never turned off the faucet, you're never addressing the problem. If you really want to solve the problem, you have to first turn off the faucet and then proceed with cleaning up the mess. And so King, I use that conceptual metaphor to try to think about what King is talking about when he's talking about derivative injustices versus causative injustices. And the struggle for human rights today must advance beyond mopping up the floor. We tend to fight, I want to respectfully suggest, we tend to fight the symptoms and not the source. Well-intentioned, I might add. But King's last speech, in which people tend to remember the I've been to the mountaintop portion of the speech on April 3rd, 1968. We remember that I've been to the mountaintop portion of the speech. But few people remember his critique of banks in the middle portion of the speech. King told the audience there in Memphis, remember, he's there fighting for the rights of sanitation workers. And King says, quote, also in the human rights revolution, if something isn't done and done in a hurry to bring the colored peoples of the world out of their long years of poverty, their long years of hurt and neglect, the whole world is doomed. It's all right to talk about streets flowing with milk and honey. But God has commanded us to be concerned about the slums down here and his children who can't eat 3 square meals a day. Now, the whole thing we all have to do is this, he says. Always anchor our eternal direct action with the power of economic withdrawal. Mm-hmm. And I call on you to take your money out of the banks downtown, deposit your money in Tri-State Bank, he says. We want a bank-in movement in Memphis. We begin the process of building a greater economic base, unquote. Economic justice is the unfinished work of the civil and human rights work of Dr. King. And while And while we do not know the full extent of his evolving thoughts on economic justice because his life was taken from him too soon, nonetheless, his concern about the economic realities in this country reflect an effort on King's part to focus not just on the symptomatic issues we so often focus on, but on what King would call causative injustices. King said, "What good is it to have the right to sit at a lunch counter if you can't afford to buy the burger?" King understood that money and economics were the cause of the darkness that we face in the world today. With all of the necessary issues that perhaps can be and should be a part of our evolving comprehensive platform, issues like campaign finance reform, getting money out of politics, ending Citizens United, protecting voter rights, environmental protection, banking and financial regulatory reform, I believe that King's evolving thinking around economics and money would have caused him to oppose our current monetary system in which money is issued by private banks as an interest-bearing debt to the public. We need a public money system where the benefit of money issuance goes to the people who work hard in this country, and where the benefit of money creation and money issuance goes towards public infrastructure, roads, schools, jobs, the environment, rather than to the benefit of the money issuers who account for maybe 1% of 1% of the population. Think about this. The average American probably works 40 to 60 hours a week paying interest on debt-based money. Paying interest on a mortgage, most of which is front-loaded with interest, on a car note, what else? On a school loan, probably a Macy's credit card. Everything we buy, the cost of it is probably bid up by, what, 40% because of our debt-based money system. The labor productivity and the prosperity of the public goes to people who earn, and institutions who earn, an unearned economic benefit from merely issuing the nation's money. We can do better than this, I believe. We must do better than this. Our future requires it. Can I give you another conceptual metaphor?
Yes!
Quickliness.
Yeah. So one of the conceptual metaphors to help me grasp the implications of a debt-based money system is musical chairs. Musical chairs, there are not enough chairs for the number of people in the game. And if you play musical chairs, it's a fun game. It's a fun game until you don't have a chair. And when the music stops, what happens? People push, people shove, people can get very violent playing a game. Why? Because there are not enough chairs for the number of people in the game. Debt-based money systems are a lot like musical chairs, okay? Now I realize I may not be articulating this in a way that's acceptable to subject matter experts, but the principle still lies. Debt-based money system creates an environment in which the principal amount of money is in circulation, but the interest portion of money is not. If I could create a hypothetical community, and I've written about this in the Huffington Post recently in an article I wrote on Palm Sunday entitled Jesus and the Money System in April of this year, I advanced this hypothetical community. Imagine there are 10 people in a community, and each of those 10 people are issued $1,000 that they have to pay back to me at some arbitrary interest rate, let's just say 10%. I'm helping you, I'm just sharing this to help you get a framework, a conceptual framework. Well, the problem is they have to pay back this interest, this money that I've made available to them, put in circulation at some interest rate, let's say 10%, and they can keep the rest. They can work, they can do whatever they desire to do to earn money. Well, the problem it creates for them economically is a mathematical one. There's $10,000 in circulation, but how much do they owe?
$11,000.
They owe $11,000. Now, that extra interest portion of money is not in circulation. Okay? This debt-based money system that they're in puts them in an inherently competitive and violent economic contest of competing for insufficient economic resources. Are you with me?
Absolutely.
A lot like musical chairs. Now, some may say, perhaps rightly so, that depending on the flow of money, this situation could be resolved if a person was willing to defer eating food every day, and maybe having lights at night, and having a jacket in the wintertime. Maybe this dynamic could be solved if some of the people were willing to defer basic necessities.
That's right.
Then maybe this debt-based money system could work. But I think most of us would like, you know, some berries in the morning and, you know, a nice kale and quinoa salad for lunch. And then something with a glass of wine for dinner. Generally, this is what most people want. Most people don't want to be in the wintertime without having a sweater or a jacket, right? So basically, debt-based money creates in an economy where there's insufficient economic resources. I really want people to grasp this. So in that environment of money scarcity, what are those people who don't have a chair? What are they going to do? What are they going to be left to do in order to exist and subsist? Well, they're going to be forced to a range of things that many of us would not prefer. In the 21st century, we are confronted with a myriad of social and economic problems. And the American way of life and the ability for people to thrive is being compromised by unemployment, underfunded public schools, crumbling community infrastructure like roads and bridges, cuts to social programs, unaffordable housing market. We see gentrification happening in every major city in America. Lack of investments to protect the environment, state budgets dwindling, and the mass incarceration of people for crimes associated with poverty. And while taxes and the cost of living continue to rise, we are constantly told by elected officials that there's insufficient money available to fund the needs of our society. That is simply not true. The lion's share of the economic pie is going to pay interest at federal level, state level, local level, and individual levels on the issuance of debt-based money. Trillions of dollars are going annually to merely pay interest on debt-based money. And while the country continues to be shackled by debt, stagnation, and budgetary shortfalls, the financial industry that caused the global financial crisis has emerged from the recent global crisis bigger and wealthier and more arrogant than it was before. That the industry that caused the greatest financial collapse since the Great Depression is now larger than it was before the crisis ought to cause every American to focus their attention on the relationship between our money system, banking, and the range of social and economic issues that plague our nation today. Rather than remaining divided over a range of political causes and agendas that are symptoms, I want to contend, of our underlying money system, legitimate symptoms, real symptoms. When you get sick, the symptoms are real, but they may not be the systemic cause of the problem. It is much more constructive for citizens, politicians, advocates, and activists to focus our collective efforts on understanding and correcting the root cause of our economic injustice and social disparities in America. Now, I want to pause and say, because oftentimes when we talk about money reform, some bright, intelligent, gifted person will say, well, money reform does not solve all issues. That is true. Money reform may not solve all issues, but I do believe that it creates the conditions where many of the issues we're wrestling with are no longer necessary. I would contend that many of our discourses of difference are necessary ideologies in a money system based on scarcity. If there are not enough economic chairs for the number of people in the game, you need a discourse of difference, racism, sexism, Islamophobia, homophobia, anti-immigrant rhetoric. You need a discourse of difference to determine who's going to have a seat or a place at the table. But if we are able to imagine, and it really takes courage to imagine an economy based on sufficiency, not insufficiency, but sufficiency. If there are 10 people for 10 people in the game, if there are 10 chairs for 10 people in the game, hopefully over time they'll realize, maybe I don't need to push you aside. Maybe I don't need to shove you because you have a seat, we all have a place at the table. Mm-hmm. So yes, money reform may not, a public money system may not address all the issues, but I believe it's a foundational issue that we must address. And at its core, our money system appears to be the foundational systemic reality that produces much of the poverty, inequality, and injustice in our society. So I am delighted to be here today and to work with folks across the country, to work with faith leaders, to work with the American Monetary Institute. I'll be working with faith leaders over the next year to launch on April 4th. A campaign called the New Abolitionism to really invite faith leaders to reclaim the theology of economics that has been at the foundation of the major religions of the world. It is principally just Islam that has maintained its historic critique of macro usury, and has principally been Christianity in all of its various recensions, Protestantism, Catholicism, and Orthodox traditions, and Judaism, which have given up their historic critiques and positions on the way in which macro usury destabilizes our society.
Where will that be?
Oh, well, it's gonna launch at my church. I'm not here to give a commercial about it because I'm very respectful for why we're here, but it's gonna launch April 4th through the 6th. Of next year. The 4th is the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination. We are having a colloquy on October 31st and November the 1st, bringing together bankers and economists to address some foundational assumptions about money. We're bringing together faith leaders to have an interfaith symposium on usury the afternoon of October 1st, 31st rather.
This year.
This is an initial sort of pre-launch colloquy on money.
October 31st to November.
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. The website, I wish I had the website for, I think it's gonna be thenewabolitionism.org, But nonetheless, the whole point and purpose of this effort is to reclaim the theology of economics and the major religions of the world, working with Protestants, Catholics, you know, Episcopalians, others around this whole issue. I'm going to pause. I have, you know, more, but I think that's enough. I think that what I do want to say is I really believe that this is so critical now. As I said earlier, we do need a unifying meta-narrative that links the disparate groups on the left. As long as we continue to be divided by our issue of that we're passionate about, whether it's the environment, LGBTQ rights, mass incarceration, you know, Black Lives Matter, police accountability, education, as long as we continue to be divided, we'll continue to be taken advantage of. And we need a narrative that links us together, that unifies us together. All Americans, regardless of your race, regardless of your background, if we're to have any hope, Democrats, Republicans, and independents, if we have any hope of pushing back against the 0.1% that's determined to keep all of us in interest and debt servitude. Thanks for listening to me today, and I yield to Joe Bongiovanni and Jamie Walter.
Wait, before you go, so if we want to get our faith leaders in touch with you and the website is not open yet, how is a good place for them to get in touch with you about that?
Best way is to email my office at Office of the Pastor.
Can you write it?
Yeah.
So this is the email to my office, but best way.
I wanted to add on to your metaphor about eye on the ball was that when I lived on a collective community for 10 years, and when we founded it, we said, well, it's got to have a spiritual basis because communities that don't last. I'm thinking that when you mentioned something about the movement and what you're doing, I think that's an important thing for bringing us together. We need to have the gravitas that a spiritual base gives us for a movement to make this kind of change if we don't want it to be violent.
This is the email address. Send me an email, Office of the Pastor. We'll make sure that once the website goes up, my executive assistant will make sure
you
get that information.
Wow, so you can imagine how I feel coming up here after that. What am I going to say? Well, one of the things that I want to say is I'm the happiest guy in the room.
Yeah.
Okay? Because why? Because I've been doing monetary reform for about 40 years. And the day I got a call from Reverend Delman Coates telling me that, you know, Joe, I've been watching some of the videos that you guys made, and I think you guys might be on to something. And to be honest with you, the world's not going to be the same because of that, okay? And I won't say because of the video I watched, but because of Dr. Coates' presence here in this scene. And I just want to make a very brief comment, if I could, because about the thing about confronting the unjust systems and the excessive interest in usury, because there's this concept that, well, the banks only charge this much, okay? But this is what I want to, on that subject, okay, I want you to just take this one home. For every dollar that's ever been created by the private banks as money, they have been collecting interest ever since. And they, if we don't stop this, they will continue to collect interest ever since in the future forever and ever. Perennially, they will collect interest. Every dollar that comes into the money supply increases the money supply, and they collect interest on that. And then when they write a new debt, and they collect interest on that. So if we're going to stop that, that massive collection from the 99% of the interest on all the money that they create, put it up to the 1%, if we're going to stop the financialization of our national economy and our national well-being, we're going to do it by reforming the money system. And so with that, that's all I'm going to say. That's how we're going to turn off the faucet. Okay? That's how we're going to provide 10 chairs so that the theory, that the theme of our existence becomes cooperation and not competition. And thanks to Reverend Coates, I think we are headed for doing that, which is where Gar Albrecht left us on the other night. We're going to all do this. We're changing. The world is changing. We're going to institutionalize the change. We're going to change the systems. These are the systems that we have to change. Now we're open for comments.
We'll do it as part of the Q&A.
I'm going by what's on the clock.
So I've just got some slides. If there's questions, that I can refer to slides, that'll help. But Sue, do you want to start taking some
questions? What is your latest take about, we've got some time here, at least 10 minutes for questions and interaction with people. We've had a dynamic talk here, and there might be some
questions
that people want to share.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying, to ask questions, and then if there's something that relates to something I've got.
Let's take four questions at a time, and then
so is there
one, two, three, four.
Hi, Charlie Cooper from Maryland. At the end of the 19th century, populist farmers suggested that money should be based on grain. And here recently, Richard Strainer has written a book suggesting that the federal government should start printing treasury notes again, which it hasn't done for a long, long time. Is there any plan, or are we going to formulate a plan for what would be the basis of a money system?
Well,
Jamie.
Why don't you take all four questions and then address?
Okay.
No. You know what? I think I want one question at a time because you forget the other question.
Right.
Yeah. So let's answer one at a time.
Well, yes, we've got a plan. We've introduced it into Congress in 2011. It's called the NEED Act, and that's what I was going to talk about. At last year's AMI conference, Reverend Coates said that we should start at the end of the NEED Act. So this is. The NEED Act does full employment, over 50 million jobs, fully funding government at all levels, federal, state, local, school districts, fire districts, tribal councils, Chicago. So, the NEED Act does these things. By taking back the power of money that is given to the federal government in the Constitution, we can do all these things. Fully fund infrastructure, and by infrastructure we include social infrastructure like education, healthcare. It also includes environmental restoration, you know, cleaning up the rivers, cleaning up the air, retrofitting buildings to be more energy efficient, developing sustainable energy systems. All of these things that everybody at this conference and everybody basically in the world wants, this legislation pays for it.
To directly answer the question though, if the government now issues U.S. Treasury notes, as you're suggesting, and the banks are still allowed to create money, that's going to equal inflation or hyperinflation. So you've got to decide basically what source you want your money or how you want your money to be created. And I would suggest, or AMI suggests, morally, if we're going to create the money, we have to do it for everyone. And it cannot have private banks with a small private interest group doing it, but it's got to be representative of all of us. So it has to be a public, and indeed, it becomes a U.S. dollar instead of a Federal Reserve dollar. So it's
can I add just one little thing?
Mm-hmm.
I want to make clear that a lot of this stuff has not been finalized, but there are different opinions. To go directly to your question, what should money be backed by? My own personal opinion is it will be the population in the country, because that's the only thing that fluctuates that tells you really how much money you should have in that society is the number of people in that society. Every time somebody's born, more resources are needed. Every time somebody dies, less resources are needed. So if you're going to back by anything, gold, grain, whatever, I would suggest population first.
Back with anything.
And I am familiar with Professor Strainer's book. He recently spoke at a conference I had. I'm also the president of the Black Church Center for Justice and Equality. And we had a conference on money reform and economic justice last November or October. Professor Strainer was there. I've had a great lunch with him and great time with him. Incredible person, incredibly thoughtful. He has the same analysis of the problems. His solution is decidedly different. He has more of a hybrid perspective, which is a bit different than the AMI approach. He sees government money, public money, mixed in with bank money. And the AMI position is that this ultimately leads to, this does not solve the problem. So he has a slightly different perspective on that. But I think that it's worth all of us getting in the room together. But he has a great piece on that. Is there? So, you know, thank you. I look forward to talking to you after. Other question?
Right here. I came from rural Minnesota. I live in the Twin Cities now. And I want my work in this area with my grandchildren and with white rural people. Because my brothers, they're on this alt-right stuff. How they got there, well, I don't know. But it was through my mother joining the John Birch Society when she was in terrible grief and she found a group. And the thing I always said to them, I still say it, and they get farther this way and I get farther this way. I couldn't deal with the anti-Semitism and the racism of that movement about the Federal Reserve.
Sure.
I knew the Federal Reserve stuff was messed up, but if you got in there, you had to take the whole drink. We're talking about a movement now that doesn't make you drink that stuff to work on the Federal Reserve. I'm just so pumped. Great.
Because this movement is not about anti-Semitism, not anti-Catholicism. The religion or race of people involved in banking in the past is immaterial to where we are today. And I believe we should eschew anything of that kind of anti-Semitic rhetoric, anti-Catholic, anti-papal rhetoric. We don't need any of that. It is totally unnecessary to this issue.
But it has stated a fact that Judaism as a religion has stayed with an attitude about money, and different churches have done it different ways. You're proposing that we all look at this and join in unity in a better way of thinking about this. You got to say it.
Well, first of all, I'm excited that you're working on this and gathering folks together. And I have a friend who's working on a dual currency system that's backed by goods and services. And I have another friend who's working on starting a local a black-led credit union. And so I'm wondering what your opinion is, like, in the meantime, before this big solution happens, like, do you support a derivative solution of a black-led credit union in an area where folks don't have much access? Would you speak about that?
I get this oftentimes. Whenever we talk about money reform, people will say, well, Delman, how is that going to help the guy on the street corner in Baltimore tomorrow who needs a job? And the reality is we have to be able to do two things at once. I mean, we have to be able to have, you know, an immediate strategy and a long-term strategy. In the Pentagon right now, there are people whose job it is to plan for the future around scenarios that have yet to even manifest themselves. And so, yes, these sort of interim notions around, you know, credit unions, black business, you know, I get, you know, what about black businesses supporting other black business? Okay, this is fine, but let's be clear about what it is. I don't want to say this is addressing the systemic problem. It's a Band-Aid. And you need Band-Aids when you're bleeding. You do, right? But it does not address, in my mind, the underlying systemic problem. I am not of the view that, I mean, that's my response. So these things are, you know, you do need short-term strategies, I suppose.
Yeah, and I just want to clarify, because we get this a bit as well, that we are not opposed at all to local currencies or any group of people working out their own mutual way of working together, mutual credit system, that's fine. What we have a problem with is that one small sector of society has been given a special privilege of having their promises backed up by the United States government, which is a privilege that nobody, the local currencies don't have. It's a privilege that cooperatives don't have. You know, it's a special privilege that is the only thing that enables banks to create our money supply. If that wasn't the case, their deposits would only be that they lend us into existence, they'd only be worth, you know, cents on the dollar. The only reason that they have been allowed to become the money that we use is because the federal government is there supporting them. And we're saying that the federal government, instead of supporting the banks, should be supporting the people, you know, which is what the Constitution says it's supposed to be doing.
Just to add to that, I think the local and regional currencies, that's how I got into monetary reform, was through them, and I don't think it's either or, it's both. And with the caveat that those groups at local and regional levels have to support the macro level, national level monetary reform. Otherwise, they're contributing to its survival. Mm-hmm. The faucet,
faucet stays on.
Continuing. And if we get this macro level monetary reform, you might have less need for local and regional. But in Appalachia and the rural communities that you're talking about, in many places, we want local economies to develop, and the local regional currencies help them do that and support their own development. But we have a national level currency that enables us to trade beyond those communities. So it's not either or, right, except we have to have the macro level work. Without that, we're leaving us all and our environment in dire mm-hmm. straits.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah. I read an article recently that attributed in part the rise of Trump to the fact that no one was prosecuted for the financial collapse, and that Eric Holder just went on to represent Wall Street banks. And also, my husband and I struck up a conversation with an employee of Best Buy Company, and he told us that he had a 28% car loan, 28% interest car loan. And I also work with a group called Isaiah, which is made up of 200 congregations in the state of Minnesota. One of their key issues is shutting down payday lenders. And so I just want to put that out on the radar.
I get the payday lending thing all the time. The ultimate payday lender. The ultimate, you know, institution that is exploiting people with interest is the banking system.
Yeah.
So again, it's not about whether we should not address payday lending. Perhaps we should. But it exists within this broader network. And if we don't address this broader dynamic, it's sort of like addressing the street corner drug dealer without addressing the folks who are bringing in the drugs. So for me, you know, that's
more
an important issue.
Over there. Yes.
Sure.
Okay.
Count them out.
One, wait a minute. One, two, three. Okay.
Actually, I have an analogy. I think, for this, and that's, we all see the pictures of the smog in China. We hear about China building coal-powered power plants, okay? And so until China stops doing that, we're not going, those are their band-aids, the power plants, because they have recognized that they need to start the root thing. They need to take care of the people and provide the power with all their new, rapid transit is electrically based, because that is electrically powered things. Houses, transportation can be easily converted to solar, to wind, to whatever. But if you're driving a gas-powered car and don't want to give that up, then, or don't want to put solar on, you know, but you want to, if you don't look at the transition, you need that banding. And we need to be careful about criticizing. I mean, China has problems. And but they are addressing that in a way. Taking care of right now, those coal-powered furnaces will be gone, apparently, before we even get really started on alternative energy.
Sure.
So, and I think that, to me, that's an analogy for this.
Absolutely. One of the things that you know, Howard here is going to be talking about the link between monetary reform and environmental sustainability this afternoon at 2:30.
Yes.
Is it Howard? Yeah, and the thing that is Reverend Coates, his analogy with the room filling with water with the faucet gushing out and everyone busily trying to mop things up is great, and it is absolutely true, and even the musical chair analogy is true. And the economists who sort of try to poo-poo that, what they're basically saying is as long as you're mopping enough of the water fast enough and putting it back and down the drain fast enough, you can keep going. But all that is a big make-work treadmill, you know?
Right.
So, and I think the treadmill, even in the time of slavery, was banned because it was called cruel and unusual punishment. So, but our system is a treadmill. It's a debt treadmill, and the reason to be able to do the things that we need to do for our environment to preserve our biosphere, we need a money supply that does not have to be paid back with interest. We need money to be able to be invested into decarbonising the atmosphere. A bank is not going to lend on that, because that is not a commercial activity that's going to generate some revenue to be able to pay back the principal and interest. We need money in our system that can be invested, that doesn't have to be paid back, that can be invested in cleaning up our environment. Banks are never going to do that because...
Right.
Because there's no way they're going to get the money back.
Jamie, one of the questions people often say, and I've met with several leading African-American economists in talking about the money reform issue, they will constantly respond with things like, well, how will people get them if you have full reserve banking, if you prevent banks from creating money, can you explain to folks how lending would work?
Sure.
And how people would get access to credit capital in a public money system, because there is this idea that lending goes away or it's going to make it difficult for people to get a mortgage. Or can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
I know. With this changeover to the NEED Act, there will be so much money available for lending that we'll actually have to take some out of circulation for a while, because it's going to release all of the savings and time deposits that have accumulated over the years. That banks do not lend those deposits. All the economists have for this model in their mind where they treat banks as intermediaries, and like we're all taught at elementary school that a bank takes savers' deposits, pays them 3%, lends out to borrowers at 5%, and makes their income on the 2% margin. That is not how banks operate at all, but all of the world's economists, and even the ones that work in central banks, some of them, they think that that's the way that banks work. It's mind-blowing, but it's only 3 years ago, in 2014, that the Bank of England finally put out a couple of papers explaining that banks create deposits when they make loans, even though this has been known by some people for decades and even centuries. But So there's going to be all of those savings deposits and time deposits that people have got will actually then now be available to be lent to borrowers. And so that's a lot of money. Then there's part of our NEED Act is that we pay off the national debt as it comes due. it's like over a 30-year period because some of the Treasury's 30-year maturities. So what are people, and the government's going to have no need to issue more Treasuries anymore, so what people who receive that money back when their treasuries and or their pension funds or whoever their investment funds, they're going to have to invest that money in the private sector, and so they're probably going to do some of that through banks, and so banks will be issuing bonds, which they already do. Banks do borrow funds. They don't borrow deposits because they create deposits, but they borrow what they call funds, or they borrow other banks' reserves at the central bank, the Federal Reserve. I don't want to get too complicated, but they will. Banks do issue bonds, and so bonds will basically replace government bonds as a safe asset for insurance companies and pension funds and all that to invest in. And so banks will be able to raise money that way to lend as well. And banks already have their own funds. They have trillions of dollars in reserves. And, you know, one of the ideas of the bailout was that, we need to give the banks reserves so that they can make loans to people. But again, the economists advising President Obama, when he said that, they either don't know or they're lying. Something else. Mm-hmm. They're trying to pretend to people that banks take reserves from the Federal Bank and lend those out to people. That's not what happens either. Okay, banks never lend reserves. They can't. They're two separate systems under the current system. What we do is make it the same system so that money can go between the Federal Reserve and banks and to borrowers. It's all in a one circuit of accounts. So banks will have their own funds that they will be able to lend out. And so they've got quite a few trillion of those. Then there's a revolving fund that's established. In normal bank lending, it'll be like the way that everyone's taught at school, okay? So people who have got some surplus or want to put some savings aside, we'll put it in banks, and banks will lend out to borrowers. And so what everyone thinks happens now will actually happen.
Right.
And then if that is insufficient at any time, there's a revolving fund that will be established that the Federal Reserve will actually lend funds to the banks, and then they will be able to on-lend them to borrowers. So that's the second thing that people think happens now. When the banks were bailed out and President Obama said we need to provide the banks with more reserves so they can make loans. Well, in this case it'll actually be true. Okay. So the two different things that people think happen now, which don't happen, can actually happen. So the short answer is there will be no
problem.
There should be no problem, no shortage of funds of being available for people to borrow and to invest with.
Just in your own words, can you just say the three things that are in the NEED Act that have to be done?
Yeah.
Because I don't think everyone knows that.
Okay, where is it? Okay. Yeah, so the three essential elements, and it's the whole NEED Act bill, when it's condensed into normal type, is only like 12 pages long. You know, it's not like a Dodd-Frank thing, which is like 3,000 pages. It's really simple, and actually, the number of laws that needed to be amended to do it was maybe five or six little amendments to clauses. The first thing is to put the Fed in the Treasury. So there is a provision already in the Federal Reserve Act that the federal government has the option of buying back the stock. And so that's just exercised. The second thing is to stop banks creating money. And that's quite simple to do. Basically what we do is instead of having banks, having your deposits being banks' liabilities, like on their balance sheet, basically, they become custodial assets of you. Like it's like a piggy bank. People have this image of a bank being a piggy bank, and your money is in the bank. But that's not the case at the moment. At the moment, the money in your bank account is legally deemed to be your unsecured loan to the bank. Yeah, it sounds crazy, but that's what.
Can you just say it one more time?
Okay.
I don't understand it.
Yeah, I know. No, don't worry. No economists understand it. Okay. So, for you,
your money will actually be your money. It won't be an unsecured loan to the bank. It'll be in safekeeping. Like, it'll be like in an electronic safety deposit box that stores your monetary units, and it can be transferred from your safety deposit box to someone else's when you make a payment directly.
Today, when you go in and you have money in your checking account, that money legally is not yours.
Yeah.
It belongs to the bank. So if the bank goes under, you have to get online with all the other creditors.
Mm. So at the moment, this is where your bank account money is. So what we do is take it out of there and put it in here. Okay? So it's safe. It doesn't matter. This bank can go out of business. Your money, along with all of the jewellery in the safety deposit boxes, is still your property, still owned by you. You can just put it into another bank that isn't going out of business. Okay? So that means that the banks can't go and point a gun to the Congress and say, you've got to bail us out, otherwise the whole payment system closes down. We'll have martial law in 3 days because the supermarkets won't be able to restock the shelves, which is what they did in 2008. They said that if you don't bail us out, it's going to be martial law.
Can you go
back
to the other
questions?
Yeah,
the other questions.
Wait,
we're going over. We got 5 minutes
the
left.
The three items in the three items.
Okay. So then
we're taking over this room.
Are they on?
Yeah.
Okay. So now, if you stop the banks from creating money, and the economy still needs some more money in the economy, you know, for a while the population will still grow, but in a few decades, they reckon that the world's population will actually peak and start declining. And the demographers reckon that we've already reached the peak child, and so it's just that, you know, it's just going to be a blip to about 9, 10 billion, and the world's population is going to start stabilizing and then slowly decline. So, and how this present system is going to survive that, I don't know. So basically, you need to create more money and do what, which is what the Constitution says. The Constitution says Congress shall have the power to do this, and it says that the federal government shall promote the general welfare. So we put these two things together, and that's why we create the full employment. So this is how much money the banks have created each year, you know, for those 10 years. So an average of this much, 540 billion. So instead of the banks creating that, the federal government created that. We can rebuild the infrastructure that is deficient. And of course, again, that includes environmental restoration. The American Society of Civil Engineering profession sort of went green about 25 years ago. So they're fully into this sustainability. There's so much, you know, now the more recent report, 3.6 trillion or 450 billion a year is needed just to bring this infrastructure up to a safe standard, you know, because, you know, bridges collapse, and I think it was here, wasn't it?
Yeah, right.
Okay, education. 6 million jobs in education, so you can have smaller classrooms, more face time between teachers and students. More people being able to access education because the NEDAC fully funds it from pre-K through to 2 and 4 year public post-secondary institutions. That includes vocational education as well, adult education, all sorts of education. And so with the same thing happens at the Federal Reserve level, their reserves are taken off their liabilities and put into custodial accounts as well. And it becomes the same money, the same as in your safety deposit box, electronic safety deposit box. And so all of these treasuries and all these other assets that the Fed has bought through the QE and through its normal open market operations, they're no longer needed to balance these liabilities. So they can be sold back in the money that the proceeds that the government receives from that one-off thing, the $4.2 trillion, that can be used to be an initial citizen's dividend. Say, if there's 320 million people, 3.2 billion of it, that's $10,000 for every man, woman, and child. that's enough to clear all the consumer debt, you know, all the high interest credit cards, like 28% auto loans, all that sort of thing. And there's still, and so that immediately reduces inequality, because if before someone's on 50, after they'd be on 60, someone on 10, you've reduced the inequality from 5-1 to 3-1, just like that, immediately. And also, you know, there should be no reason for people to be homeless on the streets and stuff and begging, and because they should be able to afford to, you know, have food and shelter, clothing.
You have the grants to the state.
Yeah, well, so there's still enough left over from that to clear all the student debt as well. Okay, so student debt is just is repaid, the government will pay it off for the students and clear them, absolve them from any debt. And so, yeah. And of course, this improves people's bargaining position in the workplace, you know. So the overall effect of all of these things is grants to the states, and there's interest-free lending available to state and local governments, so they don't have to issue bonds and pay interest as part of their budgets. So they can either provide more services, employ more people, or they can reduce taxes so that people have more disposable income to go and spend, and so businesses, small businesses can flourish and employ more people, pay better wages, all of that sort of thing. So instead of this vicious spiral that we've got at the moment, you know, this sort of dog-eat-dog world, it would be a virtuous spiral upwards.
There was another question.
There's two more questions.
Yes, yeah. Question back here. And then
Dr. Coates, when you mentioned going back to the biggest payday lender of all, and you said the banking system, and I just wondered, when we try to talk about this to other people, is that an important language thing to say the banking system instead of saying the Federal Reserve Bank, or is it the same?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question.
Federal Reserve question. And the banking system. It's not
because from my perspective, this effort is not an anti-Fed movement. It's not an anti-Fed movement. For me, it's intentional. It's not an anti-Fed notion in my mind, because there is still a need, a role rather, for the Fed in the NEED Act. So it's not an anti-Fed campaign. It's not an abolish the Fed campaign. There is still a need for a monetary authority that monitors the amount of money in the economy. So it's not an anti-Fed sort of movement. It's intentionally, in my mind, for me, focused more on commercial banks, because, I mean, if you read much of the literature, most of the money in circulation today is commercial bank created, apart from being initiated by reserves from the Federal Reserve, that the Federal Reserve accommodates the commercial bank lending after the fact, rather than needing reserves from the Fed first, and then commercial banks can create all of these loans. And so for me, it's intentionally focused on the problems of commercial banking and their power to create money.
The Federal Reserve, they do perform some important functions. They have thousands of economists studying the economy, and that's useful institutional knowledge, you know.
But is it bringing that into the government?
But we're bringing it into the government to make it useful for public purpose, and they will actually be able to. At the moment, the banks are out of control, basically. Everyone thinks that the Federal Reserve controls the banks, but that's not the way that it. That's not true. So when we change this, the money will go to through when bank loans that are already out there repaid to banks. Instead, if we didn't put this here, the banks would end up with all the money, which is now actual money. At the moment, when you repay a bank loan, that money is extinguished. The same way that it was created, it's destroyed. But now this money is going to be permanent, so it's going to pass through the banks back to the this revolving fund that's established. And the Federal Reserve is in charge of administering that revolving fund on behalf of the Treasury. The Federal Reserve is part of the Treasury, is a bureau of the Treasury, like the Mint and the Bureau of Engraving and Printing is already. And so that then enables the Federal Reserve to keep recycling money back into the economy. So basically, the Federal Reserve actually becomes federal, and it actually will have some reserves that can actually be lent out. Yeah, so everything that people think exists now will actually exist.
One more question.
So first, I just wanted to make a comment, then a question. So there was a mention of, you know, why focus on monetary reform. I talked to an anarchist a few days ago. So he made the difference of two types of reforms. There's reformist reform, which is essentially putting a bandage, and there's revolutionary reform. This is changing power structure. So a good example analogy would be in police brutality. So when there's an incident that occurs where police go over the edge, one of the solutions could be put body cams, make it always on, all the time. That is a reformist reform. It's not addressing really the fundamental root that there is a lack of training, is a lack of community connection, is judging ahead of time. So a revolutionary reform would be a civilian oversight of the police. So there's always a who are the police department, who's held accountable. It's that the citizens are held accountable of the police. So right now it's the mayor, so that is a revolutionary reform. That will create a continuous conversation. So in regards to monetary reform, it's the same way of, like, it is that, you know, how is it revolutionary reform? Maybe we have to communicate it in that sort of say, and saying, where is the power structure changing? Is it going to the people? Is it going to the banks? Is it going to the government? Because that's where it sort of resonates with people. And the second question, and maybe this is the question, I guess. So I have an economic background as well. This is confusing. This is really
confusing. He's more confused than anyone.
So what I find challenging is that because it's confusing, it allows a lot of lobbyists, a lot of conservative groups to be able to create any way they want to, you know, challenge it. So is there a way to make it, you know, I don't use the word dumbed down, to me, but for layman terms, clear layman terms. And the second question, this is the radical question, I guess, reform, is when I look at money, I think one of the really the fundamental issues of capitalism in general is this hoarding effect. So how will this monetary reform address this? And my, let me just say, a solution that I'm sort of considering is this notion of depreciation. The longer you hold money, it depreciates.
Like Sylvia Gazelle's.
Yeah.
Well, in a way we do this because we have an interest charge on, no, sorry, not an interest charge, a service charge on checking accounts, which is like the demurrage effect of Sylvia Gazelle, and that, you know, to keep money moving, people either want to spend it or invest it. It'll always be in someone's account, but people want to spend it. They won't want to hoard it because there'll be no incentive for them to hoard it.
And because what matters is the purchasing power of your money when you do need it, and that depends on the money being put to good use now by people who need it to be productive or to be consumptive. But for that's what matters, is that when you do need the money 3 years, 5 years, 20 years from now, its purchasing power, it still has the same as what it had when you put it in there. And that's what this will allow to be the case if the money goes into a time deposit.
Yeah, so what I'm really glad is I was kind of in a time warp here, you know, like we were supposed to be out of here 11:15 and we're still rolling. And onto your question, you know, yeah, I was the anarchist that, you know, that I had to confront my dad about when he was teaching me about monetary reform. And the matter of the economics of the thing, you know. And I told him, I don't really like economics, you know. And he said, well, it's a good thing that you don't like economics, because if you whatever you knew of it, you'd have to understand it in order to learn how the monetary system works. So whereas your education is great and has great value, you know, in order to accomplish, you know, many of the things that are going on in the economy, for the monetary system part, this is what I want to promise you. And my dad promised it to me, and I found it was true. There is no academic institution in this country that teaches the monetary system.
That's right.
So you have to start learning it all over again, just like everybody else in this room.
No, there's a guy in this room who wrote this book,
Marx.
And he said to me, which I haven't read it yet, this is a simple way of explaining to lay people who don't know the basics of this.
Yes.
And he's distributing and selling them down at Wiley.
Thank you very much.
Bravo. Anyway, I wanted to get to that clarity here, okay? Everybody kind of went, you know, one of the other things that my dad said to me, he said, when I finally read Frederick Soddy's book and I picked up on it, I realized how important it was, you know? And he says, well, monetary reform, Joe, he says, this is one of the problems. It ain't going to get you any girls. He says,
not sexy.
And he said, as a matter of fact, you're going to probably lose more dinner conversations than you'll ever want to, you know, find out about in your life. But in the end, this is the essential thing. This is the most important thing. And that's why when I come to find out, I'll tell you, you know, that I made a video at the AMI conference a couple years ago, which became to be titled, not by me, but which became to be titled, Why Monetary Reform Must Become Your Number One Issue. Okay? And if you want to just go to Google and put on YouTube and just put that title in there, you'll see the video that the filmmaker made when he came. And it addresses all the things that this conference is all about, which is everything, okay, as Gar said on the opening day, but this is the bridge to get from here to where we want to be. And as far as I know, it's the only bridge that exists out there that gives us potential to have the revolution with a pen and not a pitchfork. And that's a very, very important factor of us being able to make real progress in this world.
We're willing to stay and answer more questions. If you
want a table out there.
Okay. Yeah. And are there more questions?
It's also available on our website.
No?
You know, one of the things.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
You're going to be around?
I'm going to go to the
Who are you and what's this book?
My name is Mark.
Mark with a C or Mark with a K?
We're going to have to think about it. I don't know.
Because you got to think, you are.
That in order for us to get politicians to vote for something like this, they can't be bought by the banks, you know, and so on.
Don't worry, I've been talking about this guy. I haven't seen that in a long time.
Well, I mean, he got investments.
Yes. How he actually used that.
And that's, and then I was at an earlier
I'm going to get up on us.
I'm going to get up.
Lawrence Summers.
Well, you
Well, you know, the best workshops are the ones that make you feel complete.
Well, okay, yeah. How much you selling this for?
One of the things that I keep getting is the pros for if there's full reserve bank, if there's full reserve bank.
Well, it's not full reserve bank. You're not going to make one of us think I'm
not full reserve.
No, I don't know.
What kind of a book doesn't have the picture of the biography?
Mine too. My publisher said, hey, where's your pretty art? I don't know, pay for one.
I'm gonna make that big page so I know it's Mark Antony, wow.
Because everybody has some place to go, but nobody's in a hurry right now. Nobody has to run across the hall or anything, you know. And nobody's going to open the doors and come running in.
But
First of all, we've got a bunch of us. We have a bunch of presentations. So all this is helpful. But, you know, when you have people staying out here wanting to talk. So for us, the first session we get is all that.
Oh my God,
everybody in the room is
How should you deal with this one now? And is she going to do it right now where we can hear his explanation?
And then we're in a department store and there's just drinking fountains.
Just arrived.
There's a line at the white fountain. There's no line at the colored fountain for obvious reasons, but I do have obvious reasons. And so I go to the white fountain and there's no line. You can't drink there. Well, I mean, that was a good way to explain to a child. I mean, because we're living in a community of bigots, that's right, you know. So I came back here to finish my CA, which I had done. And I get into med school, the first day of med school. Everybody's kind of like, did they make a mistake? I figure I grew up there. I mean, I learned a lot about myself there, right?
That's my home.
It wasn't until 3 years later I got out of the like, and it wasn't until 3 years later that I some we were ship sitting at the end of the rock and out the local newspaper in there gets a letter that Barbara Berg is graduating from the University of Minnesota. And that's what they wanted it for. They wanted to notify the hometown newspaper. I assume there was an Arabic language newspaper in Morocco, which I couldn't read because my spoken Arabic was enough to be used. So I assume there was a newspaper there, and I just heard the plan. That's where the announcement is. That was my hometown. So they're letting me know, oh, you're a local child that grew up there, that everybody in town knows. Right? They're all going to be so excited to know, that she graduated from the University of Minnesota. That's America. So I envy you were in kindergarten with people that you can call and say, remember. I mean, that's, I just see if that's what that's what that really is. I will say that you may have not noticed because everybody's graduating up to go.
but I went back to Memphis for the old economy. A long time after I'd left. And I've been in her wedding.
His analogy was.
So I called her and said, yeah, I'm coming down for a moment. She said, oh, great. So she had an open house and invited everybody that we knew then, people lived on my street, and you know, all these people. They were the same. There was this shitty little boy that lived next door on my block. His mother always thought was, well, his mother didn't understand him, and she would give him. I said, Tony was a bastard bully. He beat up on his little brother. He was a shit. He was, oh, no, he was, I said, no, he wasn't misunderstood. He was a shit. Well, he ended up involved with tax fraud. He was still a shit. And he came a half an hour early so he wouldn't have to see anybody else. He was curious how I answered that. And then he snuck out before anybody else.
Yep.
He didn't want them to see me. They bat him out. A little girl that I knew here, she loved dancing. She
loved dancing.
She was the most important, awesome person in his band. I mean, she likes to be a white person who's ever met a black person to dancing to black music. And that was a never seen it, no clue. And, yeah, I mean, you know, sad. But she loved getting dressed up in costumes, and she would go and see abroad, and she was happy. But Grace was utterly sweet lady, Grace. She came, flaming red hair, followed and respectful three steps by my husband in cowboy boots. And the whole thing was drooling as he follows after. And I said, are you still dancing? She said, oh, yeah, now I'm doing belly dance, and my husband loves it.
All that matters.
She
kept it herself. I never would have done
that. Still a wonderful I think so. You have hardcover bigger books?
Yeah, and, no, I was just saying I have different
books. Yeah, Cuba did hardcover bankers. They denied it. They think, oh, we said we were
just this is the hardcover
my quick skin is this is great. There is a couple of companies married in the middle that are not discussed afterwards, so it's not to frighten anybody. And on the next to last page, the first which is now
how can you talk about it?
The DEED Act would get us to.
So it would be great when the government on that one in 67 or 5 months. Depends on how long the program is. I don't want to change the government.
Now he's talking about going the outside by side to get rid of the bank.
Oh, yeah, I made it. Yeah, on time. We're going to go
find some. We're not getting
some.
Oh, I see. And that's what this would do to me. So you're talking about the same system.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where's lunch?
But he's more specific.
And I think he was talking about just sharing with them about the company here.
Right.
So a lot of the stuff they've already started.